Wait, wait, stop. That's the one.
Welcome to Zenten Speaks, a show where I make new friends and reconnect with old ones. A show where everyone's stories may inspire you to tell your own story. In this podcast, we encourage everyone to get rid of shame, guilt, fear, doubt, and judgments for themselves and for others, and replace those with love, empathy, compassion, understanding, kindness, and to do your best in everything that you do. In essence, to get rid of things that no longer serve your well-being, to be true to yourself and be honest with others.
So today we have our guest. Our guest today is Jack Gray. Jack is a speaker and a performer coach, and he is a creator of Fear to Freedom, Stories of Triumph After Leaving a High Control Group. And that's a book. That book has many other authors in there, including, that's the book right there. And I'll also put a link on the description note. The book has others that I've also interviewed on this podcast, including Rodney Allgood, as well as Gary Alt. So Jack was an elder of the Jehovah's Witness religion, which he was also raised in, but he is no longer a Jehovah's Witness as of 2013 or 14. And presently, he is thriving to rebuilding the lives of ex-JWs. So welcome, Jack, to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Definitely. Thank you. So there will be links of Facebook, YouTube, as well as the website on the show notes, so you can visit Jack and his work. So Jack, tell us who you are and what brings you joy.
What brings me joy? That's a great question. Actually, no, nobody ever asked me that before. It's great. I like to start on the positive note. Who am I? Well, I was born and raised in a divided household. So my father was a Catholic, my mother was a Jehovah's Witness, and I got three sisters. My father put up a little bit of a fight towards us being Catholics. My mom obviously had a stronger influence on us, but I think the fact that he put up that fight, it brought us close together, and he also brought us in a, such a way that we were very strong believers, because we literally had to fight for it. You know what I mean? It wasn't the kind of environment when mom and dad would had to force the children to study. No, we actually were hiding from my father all the books. We were hiding going to service. You know, if he found out that we were in service going door to door, then there'll be hell at home. Excuse me, at home. So that kind of environment really, first of all, it was very fearful. We were every single day when he was coming home, we were just listening. He's, oh, is he coming? You know, are the books all hidden, right? And then he's, it's this moment whether he's going to start yelling or not, right? It's like, oh, he's not yelling. Right? So you live in fear pretty much every single day, right? And that was the kind of persecution that Jehovah's Witnesses talk about that causes you to have your faith even stronger, right? Uh-huh. A lot of Jehovah's Witnesses grow up in this kind of environment when the parents are constantly pushing the doctrines on them, and they're like dragging them to the meetings, dragging them to service, and then they can't wait to get out, or they might like it or not like it. Asbury was like, you know, we had a common enemy. Nothing unites people more than a common enemy. So our faith grew really strong. My sisters were pioneers. One served in Bethel. I became an elder. They're all married with to guys who are elders. Very zealous, right? So for me to wake up and get out of that, it was extremely, extremely difficult, right? I would say it was not only life-changing, but it was kind of like mentally very challenging, because not only I was able to bring some people into the organization, but I was fighting for it, you know, and for me it was like, this is the truth. There's nothing else outside that is that nobody else has better answers than us, right? Like, we have the truth, we are in the truth. So it was very challenging. But you know what? To answer your question about joy, I think I was always a joyful person. When I was a Jehovah's Witness, I was a joyful person. There was a brief moment when, I woke up and realized that the whole thing is not the truth, where my joy literally disappeared, and anxiety and depression and PTSD, I guess, kicked in. But after I recovered, the joy came back, and I think the joy came back even 10 times more than before, simply because I was able to express it the way I wanted to without the framework of Jehovah's Witnesses, right? Today, I think the biggest joy that I get is to see how much of an impact I can make on other people. When I see that, what I do or how I can help them, to see that they're progressing and they're rebuilding their life, that brings me enormous amount of joy.
Definitely. And in servicing others, you totally have joy. When I was Jehovah's Witness, I had joy constantly, actually, because going to field services and
Right.
talking about Jehovah all the time, it brings that light. And well, it's not unfortunate, but it's kind of like you're talking about something that, well, to me now, it doesn't exist and it was a fairy tale. And
Right.
so if that can bring me joy, so if I'm in the real world, I can keep having that practice and have my true joy in my current life right now. And so if I can do it for this, I can do it for my current life. So what was the shame, guilt, and fear that you carried on in your life while you were a Jehovah's Witness or when you got out? And how did you overcome the shame, fear, and guilt?
Shame, fear, and guilt. Oh, that's a loaded question too. Shame. I don't think I was ashamed of anything that I have done. I don't think I carry that. There was a moment when I felt like, oh, you know what? Maybe the people I preached to, maybe the Bible studies that I had, maybe the person I brought into the organization, it's kind of like you feel guilty. But you know what? No, I never had that, to be honest, because I was always true to what I believed. You know what I mean? So back then, I believed that was the best thing I could do. That was the best knowledge, the best religion, the best truth, right? So I was spreading what I believed was the best. I believed that that was the best way of life. Therefore, I was trying to help people. I never forced anybody. You know what I mean? So I didn't have that really. I didn't have any regrets, as a matter of fact. I didn't have regrets of being a Jehovah's Witness. It was just part of my life, and it led me to where I am. If I were not a Jehovah's Witness, most likely I would have been a Catholic, right? Would that be a better life? Would that be more happy and joyful life? I don't know. Maybe not. To be honest, my dad was taking me to a Catholic church. My mother was taking me to a Kingdom Hall. I always prefer to go to a Kingdom Hall versus Catholic church. It always looked weird to me that everybody was saying exactly the same prayers, word for word, all together at the same time, and bowing down to statues, kissing the priest on the ring, and stuff like that, and getting down on their knees. It made me feel very uncomfortable. It made me look like you're just, for me, it was just weird, to the point where I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. And everybody would get down on their knees. And there'll be two people standing. One was priest and one was me. And my father was like, "What are you doing? Get down on your knees." I'm like, "I ain't doing
Right.
that shit."
When
I
I
just
left,
remember, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? They're not gonna bow down to the golden statue, like from my book of Bible stories. And like, I ain't bowing that to that.
right.
So very quickly, my father was actually embarrassed, to take me to church. So he stopped. But I think this is why I don't regret, because I believe that what they were doing was wrong. And as a small child, I was able to stand up for myself and had the strength. Inside, I was shaking, right? I was really terrified. What will be the reaction of people that are in the crowd? There are people from my school. There are, people that my aunts and uncles, my father, like my family's there, all looking at me, standing, like one guy standing, and he's like, I don't know, 12 years old, 10 years old, while all they're following what the priest says, right? So I think everybody's got that courage to go against the crowd if they believe strong enough. And I think Jehovah's Witnesses have that. They have that kind of faith that is so strong that they would be willing to die for, right? For their beliefs. Mm-hmm. They would go against Hitler, right? They would not join the war, no matter what the consequences would be. They would rather end up in a concentration camp than pick up a gun or say, "Hi, Hitler," right? So we got to give them that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know about you, but when I was in it, my faith was so strong that I was willing to do almost anything to uphold it, right?
Yeah, I'm grateful for that part that was installed in us, definitely. Because I carry it on my life currently, and I love it. Wow, that's wonderful. And so definitely the courage. And it's funny, as you're talking about, as you're a child, you're strong. And I've noticed one thing, because I've spoken to a lot of ex-JWs, how we were strong for they don't promote individuality. We're strong for the religion, for what we believed in. But once we are that term, when they say you're physically in and mentally out, we're not strong enough to get out on our own, even if you're going to be homeless or kicked out of our families and start over. Of course, later on, we become strong because you and I left. But we stay in there for so long because we're afraid. But then we're strong for Jehovah. We have that strength, but it's directed not in the wrong direction, but it's directed in the direction that it probably doesn't need to be, could be directed to us. And yes. I wonder, so question for you is, have you taken that strength that you had for Jehovah and used it in your everyday life as a worldly person?
That is a great question. And yes, as a matter of fact, that was part of the crisis that every Jehovah's Witnesses is going through, is when they realize this is not the truth and they have to make a decision, right? And the decision usually is, okay, I rather stay in, right, and pretend that I believe, and they call them what, physically in, mentally out, or they get out completely and try to fade slowly, or they just make a statement, write a letter and say, I'm done with it. And the consequences are, you know, as we know, shunning. I had the discussion with my wife, because my wife was like, oh no, you know, we should stay as PMOs, right? I should stay like physically in and mentally out. We don't have to believe everything. You know, not every Catholic that goes to church believes that, the priest is saying, right? Most of them, they don't even know half of the doctrines, and yet they're still going. They're still able to keep their community. Uh-huh. So we could be the same, right? We could just go on Sunday, listen to what they have to say, and at least we'll have our family, friends, and still the community. We don't have to believe it. We don't have to participate. Like, you don't have to be an elder, right? But at least keep the community. That was her case. And at the beginning, that's what I did, because I was hoping that I could actually manage, right, to stay in and pretend that I believe for the sake of the family and the kids and the friends. But very quickly, I realized, you know what, as Jehovah's Witnesses, we were literally taught to speak the truth no matter what.
Yes.
We're taught to stand in front of judges and in front of, you know, whoever stands in front of us. As a child, you know, you're standing in front of teacher and you have to explain, this is what I believe, and I'm not going to stand up for a national anthem, and I'm not going to do the Christmas tree, and I'm not going to do this, because we believed it so strong that, you know, no matter who speaks in front of us, we should be able to stand up for what we believe. Now I believe something different. I believe that, you know, this is the truth, not Jehovah's Witnesses. Why am I lacking the same courage? Right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I thought about it, like, no, you know what? I have to be loyal to my values, not loyal to the organization, uh-huh. not loyal to people who are trying to mislead me. And if my values is I have to be truthful, right? Then I'll speak the truth no matter what. I could be wrong, but those are my values. If I'm lying, if I'm misled, if somebody can prove to me that what I'm saying is wrong, please, my door is open. I'll be more than happy to sit with people and maybe I'll change my mind. If they present the evidence, I'm not blind. I'll be happy to change my mind. I changed my mind more than once, right? So did you. So I'm like, if somebody presents to me the evidence, I'll be happy to change my mind. I won't go around like Jehovah's Witnesses go door to door and trying to push their religion on people. I won't do that. But when people come to me and then they ask me, why do you believe this? I won't lie to them. You know what I mean? So I actually use the same psychology that Jehovah's Witnesses had of, we should speak the truth no matter who's standing in front of us. And I said, I'll do the same. I'll just be basically following what they're said.
Right.
I believe that is important. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's wonderful. So how was your childhood being raised Jehovah's Witness?
It was, my childhood was a little bit different because I was mostly raised by my sister. So when I was about 9 years old, my mother left. Their marriage didn't last. And my sister basically took over, right? My sister was quite strict. So, you know, mother has this kind of a, you know, if you mess up and you cry, then the mother will be soft. No, not my sister. she was quite tough, right? So it was always, you know, Monday afternoon, there was this Bible study, and we have to go to all the meetings and service 3 to 4 times a week, with 3 meetings, right, during the week back then. And the closest Kingdom Hall that we had was 45 minutes walk. It didn't matter whether it was raining, it didn't matter it was winter, we were walking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was tough, but at the same time, I think because my father was a Catholic and all my cousins, and I grew up in literally a small village, there were very few witnesses there, I was always allowed to play with the worldly kids. I would go for sleepovers to my cousins. I had a more or less more normal childhood than a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses who are very sheltered of, oh, you can't even play soccer with these worldly kids, right? That, you know, after school, you cannot go and play basketball because they're worldly, they have bad influence on you. I never had that. I'm very grateful, at least for the fact that I had more or less normal childhood, and I was competing in sports and stuff like this, and there was nothing wrong with it, right? So compared to average, I think I was a very average kid. I can't say that I was some sort of, you know, abnormal. Obviously, no birthdays, no holidays, but we were doing other parties and other things to compensate for that. So I never felt like I was missing out on anything, to be honest.
That's really nice. So you feel like good about it. You had a good childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. No regrets.
Yeah. No regrets. That's all great. Right. Like, I don't have bad experiences in my childhood. However, I had the sheltered childhood where I had no friends. I couldn't make friends, of course, with worldly kids, but even in the hall, because for some reason, like, I was pretty zealous as well. So my parents, they wanted to make sure I stay zealous, and they didn't let me have friends with the other kids, the other children in there, because yes, most people were non-baptized, what was that word, publishers, or they were just like kids who were studying. So they didn't want me to have bad association. And the elder kids, they were like pious as well. But it's like, it's kind of like when you're under 18 or under 16, you go to the hall, you go to meetings, and you go back to your parents' house, and you're not allowed to go out unless you supervise. So you don't really have friends. Yeah, and that was my case. Right. And I've grown to be okay with that. And well, people tell me there's a problem with it, but I don't see really a problem with it. Sometimes I wish I had friends, but I'm in New York City for 10 years, and almost all my life, I still do not have friends for some reason. Like, I kind of guess I understand why, because maybe because I grew up, I would tell people I grew up Jehovah's Witness, and I'm used to not have friends. So it's not something that I crave for, and I want everyone to be my friend. If someone's going to be my friend, they need to have the same, not the same values, but they need to have the similarities that we love each other so much, and they're like that true friend. I don't meet someone and in 2 days they're my friend kind of a thing.
Right,
because I'm
right.
So used to that, being brought up that way. And the world don't understand that, but it works for me. But sometimes in summertime, especially in summertime, I see friends hanging out, and I'm like, oh, it would be nice if I had that experience. But then it fades quickly because I'm half of my life, like up until I was 19 and a half, I was like that. So it didn't matter too much. So, what is your religion history in a timeline-ness? Because you briefly talked about it, but in a timeline from where you're raised and from leaving and why you left, etc.
So I was baptized at the age of 16, okay? About a year later, I came to Canada. And in Canada, that was my mother and my three sisters. So now my father stayed in Poland. So now I felt like finally I have freedom of religion. You know what I mean? I could go preaching. I had, you know, great experience. It took time, of course, to learn the language and stuff, but it really felt like liberation because I could be myself being a witness. This is why, you know, at the age, I don't remember exactly what, early 30s, I became an elder, previously minister, a servant, obviously. But it was always like not part of my life. It was my life. Like serving as a Jehovah's Witness was my life, and I absolutely loved it. Right. At the same time, I was going to different seminars. I was learning how to be a coach, how to help people on different levels, and a lot of the things that I was learning, I was actually implementing. As a teacher in Jehovah's Witness organization, right? So I had great feedback from people, right? Because one thing you got to know is the number one fear that I had was the fear of public speaking. It was by far the biggest. I think I would prefer to die than speak on the public, even though my first congregation had 20 people in it, max. Where 15 would show up at best, right? More like a book study, right? With two ministerial servants, not even one elder. And my first talk that I gave, I remember I was so nervous. I couldn't speak. My mouth was so dry. My body was covered with sweat. I was shaking like this. I'm like, I don't think I can do this. Right? This is crazy. So I'm like, okay, my sister's like, you know, calm down. You just go out there. You have everything written word for word. Just read it. Just read it. You don't have to look at the audience. Just go. This is your first talk. Just go there and read it. Okay. And you'll be fine. And I'm like, okay. I just remember. And I remember like, I'm going there and I'm like shaking and I'm looking at the letters and I couldn't see them. I couldn't see the letters. And I realized, oh, my eyes are getting watery. I'm starting to cry. And I'm like, sorry, it was horrible. I think by far the worst talk ever in the history of Jehovah's Witnesses. Everybody thought that I'm not gonna finish this 5-minute talk, right? And when I came down, I'm like, I never want to do this again, ever. It was the worst. And she's like, oh, don't worry, next time will be better. Next time. Once you signed up for the school, that's it. You're in it, right? I didn't even know I could cancel.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, this is really bad. And then they assigned us to the congregation in the city because this one was pretty much dying out. And in the city, it was about, you know, 50 people in the congregation. And they had a microphone, right? So my next talk is there, and I go on a platform, and they told me right before, you didn't have somebody adjust your microphone, you're supposed to do it yourself. So before the meeting, they told me, okay, this is, you unscrew here, you adjust it here, and then you screw it back in here, and you're good, right? So I go, I'm nervous 10 times more than before, right? But they said, don't worry, in a bigger audience, it's easier, right? Because you don't see the individual so close to you. It's like you see just a big crowd, right? So I go out there, I stand, you know, I screw the microphone, I adjust it, screw it back in, and the microphone fell. So at this point, everybody's laughing. And I'm like, I'm going to die. I go around the platform. I fix the microphone. I go up again. And I'm like, this is really bad. And the microphone falls again. I'm like, oh, man.
Oh, my goodness.
It's trauma at this point. You know, like I'm shaking like this. I'm like, this is really bad. So my talks were really bad. This stayed with me. That fear of public speaking stayed with me for very, very long time, years. And people are like, no, no, with time, we'll get better. I'm like, you know what? It's been a 10 years straight. Nothing's getting better. I'm still shaking like this. I still can't speak. Right? I can't even look at the audience. It was by far the worst thing ever. And then I learned NLP. I don't know if you heard about NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. And there was a program of how to overcome phobias, right? And I followed I literally did it from online and from reading books. I didn't even practice with anybody else. And I learned how to get rid of it literally in 15 minutes. Something that people take years for therapy. I'm like, boom, gone. And I'm like, I wonder if it works, right? Because at home, I'm like, oh, I can actually imagine myself talking to an audience without having
that kind of... What is that process? Right? What is that word called and what's the process?
NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, right?
Okay.
It's a basically a way of understanding how your brain works. That is basically like a computer, right? Whatever input you put in, that's the output you're going to receive. And it's a matter of learning how to put the right input into your brain so you have the right feeling that you want. So
interesting.
It is very interesting, right? So if you want to be confident and strong on the platform, you got to put in your mind the right input, right? In a regular sequence and with the right amount and so on before you go on the platform, right? So just to briefly tell you, it's like, okay, well, you got to put yourself in the right state. Imagine yourself being confident in a confident place. Room around you has to be in your favorite color. Maybe you're in a bubble. You're talking to your favorite friend at the time when you were super confident, and you go on a platform and that's what you imagine. You don't imagine the people around you and thinking about what they're going to say after and so on and on. No, you're in your favorite color bubble with your favorite friend and you're talking to them at the time when you were super confident. And if you do it properly, that's the amount, that's the feeling you're going to get when you're on the platform. So I went on the platform and I just delivered speech pretty much the way I'm talking to you right now, totally confident, totally, you know, relaxed. And people in the audience, I literally saw people going like,
they were waiting for another drama.
There's a different person up there, right? So I found those tools being very useful and I started using them in service. I started using them on the platform. So when I became an elder, I was giving great talks in different congregations. People were finding me in the assembly, right? And they're like, you're the brother who gave a talk in my congregation. I still remember, right? Like it was 2 years ago. And then like, it was so amazing. So I got a lot of great feedback and made me feel really good. So I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I was very happy being a witness. You know what I mean? I can't say that I had regrets or it was a drag. No, I loved it. I loved the brotherhood. I loved the brothers in it. Even the body of elders that I was serving, I cannot find one bad word to say about them. Seriously, we had many judicial committees and pretty much without one exception when the person became a criminal. everybody got a private reproval and the matters were handled with love. There was always this, I tell you, there was one elder who always asked this question and literally transformed the body of elders. One question he asked is, what's the most loving thing to do here? In every case, and it literally transformed our way of thinking from what does the book say we should do to what truly is the best for that person. So I was very happy to be a witness. I cannot say one bad word neither about the elders or no, nothing. It's just, I clearly left because of studying the doctrine, studying literally the Bible first and studying the history of Jehovah's Witnesses, where the doctrines came from. And when I realized that they don't align, that the teachings are not aligned with what the scriptures are saying, they're not aligned with history, they're not aligned with science and logic, then, you know, sooner or later, you can't continue, right? But I can't say anything bad about the people, no. So that's, that's why I left. I started questioning. I didn't leave in 2013. I started questioning in 2013 because in 2013, they came up with this overlapping generation change of doctrine. And for me, I was like, this is insult to our intelligence. many people question. As a matter of fact, I talked to 9 different elders about this issue. Every single one of them admitted to me they don't believe it. Okay. Nobody believed that overlapping generation, but they're too afraid to express it, to say it, right? For them, it doesn't matter. They're like, oh, it's a small thing. Maybe it will be revised again. You know, it's not why I'm here. You know, this is the best religion. So regardless of, you know, that one thing or the other might not be correct, but majority of it is correct. There is nothing better, right?
So, I thought Mormon was the best religion.
Mormon? Well, if you want to be a god and have your own planet, you should go for Mormonism, absolutely. If you want to live in paradise on earth, become a Jehovah's Witness. If you want 72 virgins, become a Muslim. I don't know. Depends what you want, right?
Yeah.
Depends on the outcome that you desire. You got to choose the right religion, right?
Correct. I've heard about that, what's it called, new light kind of a thing. And I actually only heard of it when I started doing interviews with Jehovah's Witnesses, and I couldn't help to laugh about it. So I don't remember exactly what I left, but I think one of the big chunk of the reasons I left is because my parents, growing up, I saw all the contradictory stuff they were doing and criminal stuff they're doing, especially my mother. And especially my mother was very physically abusive, verbally abusive. My dad was just verbal, not physical. But it was normal for me because it happens to my siblings and I'm the last one, it's happening to me. So I'm thinking it's normal because the Bible says like, beat the child, whatever. And as I got older and I saw all the criminal stuff, and when I would question it, I would get beat up for it. Not even like a spank, like punch, like she's a dude fighting another dude. And I'm like 15, 14, whatever. And I was very pious too, like the elders. I was the elders' favorites. I would go preaching like long hours with my favorite elder, and I saw him as my dad. And I would make all the excuses to hang out with them and do my best to not be around my parents or my family because they would abuse me so much or verbally abuse me. And I remember maybe 2000 or 99 when the thing happened with the Catholics, with the child molestation cases, et cetera. And then later on, I noticed more clearly, because I know my mother had a, you know, that in the Bible where it says the tongue is like a knife, whatever. And she had that tongue, and she said something like, you hanging out with that other elder, whatever. Like, she was saying all these bad things about him. And I was just like, okay, I understand there's a way to ask your kids, like, to ask and be there supportive, but I feel like she wasn't being supportive. She was just accusing because maybe she's jealous that I'm hanging out with them and I'm doing, I consider them worldly because I saw what they were doing. So things she would say was like so terrible. And so I was started questioning. I was just like, okay, so if they've been there since they were in their teens and we all grew up Jehovah's Witness, all 7 of us, and all these times after like 40 years, how are you like this? I'm like, that's crazy. And as I got older in my teens, I've noticed other people in the congregation were like that as well, and how they would come home and they would talk about, you know, like older people, they'll talk about other older people, and you're a kid and they don't think you have a brain to understand, they think you're dumb, but you're watching, you're learning. So I saw all of that and I said, that doesn't compute, because why are people behaving like this? And then when I started asking questions to my favorite elder, my spiritual dad, and he was very nice about it. He was very kind. And if I asked something that were maybe worldly or questionable, he says, is you don't need to ask questions, just have faith and follow Jehovah. And I accept that answer more than saying you're bad, you're apostate, like how could you, and kind of a thing. And I feel like that was an art of, that was a skill on how to say that, but differently. So someone won't feel like, because if when they call you an apostate, you're going to do it more because you want to learn more and be like, why am I a bad guy, especially when I'm pious? And so, and actually was very zealous until one time I wanted to move and I told the elders, you know, they teach you to tell on people. So I started telling on my parents the stuff they're doing. And then I'm living in the house and it was very toxic. And so I told the elders, when I turned 19, my parents gave me my, because I was working and they finally gave me my money. And, but prior to that, I tried to commit suicide 3 times. And I've also prayed to Jehovah to take my life away, because I said, I'd rather die now and wake up in paradise than living with these people. I cannot deal with it. Mm-hmm. And so a guidance counselor told me it's better not. And then I, of course, I couldn't commit suicide because then, you know, that's murder and that's whatever. And she says, it's better to just take your money and leave, or go to another Jehovah's Witness's house and live there than killing yourself because it's against your religion anyway, and you rather not die. So when I did that, that was fine. And I think with probably 5 months, I had the freedom. I was still Jehovah's Witness. And it was awkward because my parents were still there, but I had the freedom to be more pious. And they would give me a lot of shade because I was basically going to unranking that, what's that thing called before elder?
Judicial committee?
I know the terms in French, but not in...
Ministerial servant before you become...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like those things. And so, and then my dad wanted to be that, well, he was that long time ago, but I guess he got deranked. And he was like really mad. And I was like, how could you be mad? Because I'm doing the religion thing. And instead of being propping me, you have jealousy. And it didn't compute. So, but one time, like someone who helped me moved, kept asking me to go out for dinner. He's like, oh, that's the least you could do for me. And kind of a thing. And I was like, okay, I could pay him back by hanging out, whatever. And then we had sex. And I was like, oh, shit. And I was like stuck. And then I thought about it. And then I think the next day I had to go, I think we had the hall on Thursday. And that happened like maybe Monday or Tuesday. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to gravel to people and ask for forgiveness and all this stuff. And in all the shit that I saw prior as well, because I was like very black and white, strong-headed too. And I was like, I'm either going to follow 100% or if I stumble, that was like a big stumble. Not even nothing small. And then I never looked back. It's as if I died. They kept calling my phone and I just changed my number. Until this day, I never spoken to anybody. So
how long ago was that?
I think I left 2002 or 2003. Like, not clear, but probably 2002 because I graduated 2001. High school, and in 2002 I was like 19, so yeah, probably 2002 or 2003. Yeah. And so, and I've seen them on the street sometimes. I just like cross the street, and I'm someone like, I don't confront people, I don't argue, even till this day. If someone say their case, I validate their case, and if we don't agree, I'll say we agree to disagree, and I respect how you feel, and I walk away. Like, even when I was preaching, I did the same thing because people are strong in their beliefs. But then other people I would preach with, they're like, no, you fail. You know, you need to have that report card. You need to convert that person. I'm like, no, I believe that people don't change by force. You inspire people. And I do that till this day. I inspire people. Even when I'm in a relationship with people, people feel like I'm not, how you call it? I'm not all in because I'm not checking their phone. I'm not saying, where are you? I'm not saying you didn't respond to me. I'm not controlling them. I let people live. So people feel like I'm not invested because I'd rather inspire you to be how you want to be. And if you want to follow what I do, it's up to you, kind of a thing. And so, yeah, I never knew, I never questioned all the doctrine. And I guess I was still young. I feel like I was young mentally to question. Maybe if I was like in my 30s, I probably would, because then I would be part of the world and all this stuff. Because the jobs that I had going to Jehovah's Witness, I was just doing youth programs as well as working as a cashier. And your mind is not developed to ask questions. So, and like you, I do not have anything bad I want to say about them either. But about, even about my parents, like I would just tell the facts, but I wouldn't, I usually say my parents were not good people, but I don't have an opinion about them as parents because I've never been a parent. So I cannot say they were bad parents, kind of a thing.
I think from the conversations I had with Jehovah's Witnesses as an elder, and later on with many ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, I think majority of people put up a show in the Kingdom Hall, you know, how they want to be viewed compared to how they really live. Even some of my friends that I was with, who were Jehovah's Witnesses, I was embarrassed. I'm like, guys, like, why are you behaving like this? My worldly friends don't do the stuff that you want to do, right? You know what I mean? Like, you can hide from people, but you can't hide from Jehovah, right? Like, you shouldn't have that kind of a mentality, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what it is. I think it's one of those things where your parent tells you cannot do this, you can't eat this cake. All of a sudden, your desire for cake is like 10 times more, right?
Yeah.
And the call of forbidden fruit. So a lot of witnesses, they do have that life, unfortunately, right? My mother married again, but this time the second marriage was with a Jehovah's Witness. And he was a holy man in the congregation, right? Like every watchtower, he had an underline with all the callers, and he was always answering, wanting to pioneer and this and that, while he was cheating on my mom and screwing out of women. And nobody knew for years, you know. And when my mom decided to leave him because she had suspicions, but she couldn't prove it, right? They threw a judicial committee on her for leaving him. And she got public approval while they made him a pioneer, and they put him on the interview on a convention, and he went out there with my mom present in the audience saying how good it is that now he's single because he can do more for Jehovah.
Wow.
And my mother was like sitting right in the middle. She stood up and walked away.
it must have been painful to watch.
Yeah, it was crazy. So it was a great example of people who live a double life, right? Mm-hmm. I could never live a double life. I couldn't either. Authenticity is one of my top values, right? Like I told you, like speaking the truth is one of my top values. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether my Jehovah's Witnesses or not, I'll speak the truth. And to hide, to pretend and so on, you could see on my face right away. I don't have a poker face. So when I started questioning the religion, my family right away noticed that something is wrong, right? So, you know, they're like, tell us what's going on. Like, we could see that you're not yourself, right? And I'm like, oh, you know, we had this health issues in the family, and there's some problems with my wife and this and that, but it's, you know, private, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I started blaming other things so they wouldn't dig in, until literally one of my sisters is like, okay, it's all BS you're telling us. You got to tell us exactly what's going on, because you're totally not yourself. You're not acting yourself. You really, you're not yourself, right? Like I couldn't pretend. So you tell me what's going on, right? And I told her, like, listen, I'm losing my faith. There's things that I discovered that really bother me, right? And that became this kind of a domino effect, because after that one conversation with her, she called all my family. Then we went camping. We were already scheduled to go camping because we we spend a lot of time together as a family. And sitting by the fire, we talked and I expressed some of my doubts. And by the time I got home, I already had an email from one of the my brother-in-laws saying, you're reporting yourself to the elders or I will. I'm giving you 1 week, basically. And to be honest, he helped me. It felt like a threat at that moment. It felt like a blackmail, but I'm like, you know what? Maybe that's what I need. You know what I mean? I just got to cut this clean off and move on, because mentally I was a wreck, right? It was, I couldn't sleep. I was so stressed out. I remember my lungs could only open a quarter of a way. I couldn't take a full breath. I was like, that's it, right? Because of the stress. There is something called religious trauma syndrome. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But when I discovered it and I read all the symptoms, I'm like, I have every single one. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I can't think. I can't make any decisions. And I'm running a business, right? People are coming to me. They're asking for answers, asking me questions. And I'm like, I'll get back to you tomorrow. And I'm like, I can't make a simple decision, right? My brain was like a fog. It was crazy. It's very, very challenging especially for somebody who grew up in it and believed it as strongly as I did. Some people say, oh, you didn't believe it strong enough, that's why you left. I'm like, no, I was ready to die for it. I remember when we had our first daughter and I thought, whoa, what if my daughter ever needs blood, right? Like, how would I handle this? And I thought about it. I'm like, no, I wouldn't give her blood. I would let her die if he came to this. So you can't say that people didn't believe strong enough. Right. I believe so strongly I would have died because I believed in the blood doctrine so strongly. And most likely I would let my children die. So I don't think there's any other stronger proof that I was all in believer, such a strong believer, than to be willing to die for it or even sacrifice your own child for it, right? But eventually, once you are exposed to different evidence that maybe before you never knew about, you're like, hold on a second. We're supposed to be in the truth. We're supposed to know the truth. And you start asking questions like, instead of getting an answer, I'm like, where'd you find it out? Right? Like, who told you this?
Right. It's like, where did you read this from?
I'm like, from the Bible. I read it from the Bible. This is the scripture. About yeah, but who told you about the scripture? I'm like, what difference does it make?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, where were your research from? Was it Jehovah's Witness research or
that's outside? Right. That's exactly right. Right. So I'm like, listen, I was reading the Bible. I came across the scriptures and, they explained to me, like, how would you say to somebody at the door if they asked you this question, what would you explain? And they're like, I don't think you found that out on your own. What you're talking about? It's weird. It's weird because the minds are so programmed with the belief that this is the truth. And if this is the truth, that whatever contradicts it is false, is Satan's lies, deception.
Yeah.
And that belief is so strong that even if somebody does have a better answer, they can't see it. They can't acknowledge it. Right.
I think they have a fear that they'll be shunned. I think part of that is also fear that, like, oh, I can't question anything either.
No, to be honest, yeah. I disagree. I actually disagree. I think the fear of shunning only comes in when you start questioning.
Mm. Oh, when okay.
When you realize that something actually is wrong, then the fear of shunning comes in. Because I remember, I was not afraid until I discovered, when I saw the overlapping generation. Then I discovered about the Australian Royal Commission. And then I'm like, something's wrong here, right? And I discovered about the UN involvement. And only when you're like, okay, something could be wrong. And then you start the research outside of Jehovah's Witnesses, then the fear kicks in. Because then you realize, oh, this rabbit hole is much bigger than I thought. And if I keep going, right, where is going to lead me? And at the beginning, I was like, oh, well, maybe 5% is wrong, right? Of course, they're not perfect. This is, not a perfect organization. People are not perfect. They're making mistakes. We got to leave a little room for error. So maybe 5% is wrong. And then it was like, well, maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe 20. You know, at one point you're like at 50-50, right? And you only goes one direction. So that's where the fear really kicks in, because you're like, holy crap, if I keep doing this research, everything's gonna collapse. And then you realize, oh, I could be dysphagic, right? And in my case, when I started doing this research, and my wife realized at the beginning, I was terrified. I locked my door, you know, I made sure she's not home, closed all my windows, right? I'm gonna download crisis of conscience. And then my head is shaking like this. I'm like, and I kid you not, I heard the radio. I heard the radio upstairs, and I'm like, oh no, I gotta go turn it off, because if my wife comes in, I wanna hear it, right? So I go upstairs, I turn it off, and on the radio is REM, Losing My Religion. That's what was playing on the radio. I'm like, this is crazy. Satan is getting me. There's a message from Jehovah sending, you know, stop doing the research.
Right, messages.
He's telling me through the radio that I'm going to lose my religion. It's weird. But the fear kicks in, yeah, the moment you start questioning. I don't think it kicks in earlier. So when I started talking to one of my brother-in-laws, who is also an elder, because they assigned him to save me, right? So he was coming to my home and we had the discussions. And I was presenting evidence. And I literally, one time, I saw on his face when he started thinking, because what I presented made sense to him, right? And he's like, oh. And that fear kicked in. Like, I literally saw his body changing. And he's like, he got very uncomfortable, because he came to convince me that this is the truth. All of a sudden, when he was presenting the evidence and he has no defense, he's like, oh, and he literally shut down. Like, I could see on his face that he was like very uncomfortable. He started stumbling through words, and that was the last time he came. So, you know, the fear will whether win or not. For me, because my values at the very top is authenticity and truth, he won. Once I was presented with different evidence, it was a path towards truth. But for people whose values are different, let's say for them it's obedience or loyalty or community, if those are their top values and truth is at the bottom, then in order for them to wake up, they would have to create a different community. They would have to see that maybe the community they're in is failing them, right? They will have to see that the people are leading double life. They would have to see that the governing body is not always truthful. Then they'll wake up, you know what I mean? Because their values are different. So a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses, their top values are loyalty and the community and you know, the brotherhood and so on. If those are their top values, then truth will not penetrate. You can tell them the truth and they'll shut down, because like, that's not what I'm here. And that was for my wife, right? So my wife was in it because of the community and she wanted to be loyal. So me showing her the scriptures, we're showing her the history, we're showing her logical and scientific evidence meant nothing. It was like talking to a wall. It didn't matter at all. She's like, I don't care. I don't care if 1914 is not true. I don't care about 607 being wrong. I don't care about the overlapping generation. None of that mattered to her. She's like, I'm happy where I am. I'm happy with the community. I'm very happy with the congregation. People are loving. I love them. If things are wrong, who cares? There are Catholics going to church. They don't believe it. There are Muslims going to mosque. They don't believe it. The Jewish going to a temple. They don't believe it. Why do I have to believe everything, right? So I'm like, what can you say to a person like that? Only literally after we rebuild our community and she realized she can be happier and she can have true friends where she can be herself without the fear of expressing something that, you know, you got to beat around the bush or walk like eggshells on eggshells. Because if you say something wrong, they'll look at you wrong, right? They'll judge right. you. And when she realized, oh, there is a much better community, much better friendships, much better connections you can have with people. You could be more authentic, truthful, and people will love you for who you are. And there is never fear of, oh, I said something that they will disagree with and they'll shun me for life. There is no more of that. Then and only then she's like, oh, why would I hang around with Jehovah's Witnesses when I constantly have to pretend and constantly have to think about not stumbling them, and they're going to ask me questions, and I know the questions are to drill in, do I follow your husband? Are you following your husband? Are you going to fall out of the truth, right? So only after we rebuild the community, she's like, okay, then I can fade away from the previous community, right? But it depends why people in it. It's very, some people are saying, well, what's the silver bullet, right? I want to wake up somebody, my friends, my spouse, my child, right? How do I do it? And they're looking for one specific formula. And I always tell them, it all depends on why they're in it. It all depends.
Great insight.
And unless you know why they're in it, you will never be able to wake them up. Mm-hmm. Because the reason why you left is not the reason why they will leave. It could be, but mm-hmm. not necessarily. You got to first find out what are their values, what are their top values. And once you realize what are their top values, then and only then you can start working on waking them up. Otherwise, it won't work.
That's great. Which would lead me to the... So you said, I stayed to get my family out and for a few years and get my kids and other friends out. So why was it important for you to get people out?